committed to making the homeless whole again. From treatment for medical, dental, and mental health issues to vocational training to child care and housing placement, Chapman Partnership guides the homeless from hopelessness to self-sufficiency, having served over 90,000 people with a success rate upwards of 62%. You can help the homeless with your support for Chapman Partnership. Details at 877-548-6369 or chapmanpartnership.org.
And it is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman will return tomorrow. Today we begin with Brian Winston, professor of communications at the University of Lincoln, UK. We'll discuss the concept, practice, and history of freedom of expression in the Western world. He's the author of The Right to Offend, and he joins us from Lincolnshire in the UK. Welcome to you, Brian Winston.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Tell me more about Lincolnshire before we start. Where is that? I see on the internet that it has ruined some Roman times there.
Well, yes, people have been around here for some time. I suppose the most important thing to know about it is that it's the site of one of the world's greatest cathedrals, and I'm very, very fortunate. I live opposite the front door, the west, great west door. It's a perfect early English cathedral. The Victorian scholar Ruskin thought it was the most beautiful of all cathedrals. So that's it. And it sits on top of a hill and dominates the countryside for miles and miles and miles around. So that's the biggest thing about Lincoln. But the other thing which is really pertinent from the point of view of our conversation is that the cathedral actually has one of the four original copies. You know, they all had to be copied out for everybody, the original copies of Magna Carta. Now, our Prime Minister, despite his extraordinarily expensive private education, etc., etc., might not know what the words Magna Carta mean in Latin, but many of us still remember. It's the Great Charter of Rights, and I think it's true to say that for both the British and for the Americans, and indeed for the Canadians and the other members of the Commonwealth, that charter is in a sort of mythic way the basis of the freedoms that we're claiming, including the freedom of speech.
Now, the book addresses the past few decades of fatwa and such, but you even go back to Martin Luther for the right to publish. Expand on that history.
Well, the point about this is that I think the right to publish actually is bound up with the right of conscience. It's when people start saying they want to make their own personal relationship with God paramount. And, of course, in the Middle Ages, a lot of that was to do with the pomp and circumstance of the church and people feeling that that had somehow got in the way of the essential Christian message. And they started to make an argument that they ought to have free conscience and they ought to be able to express that. And it seems to me that that root has to be remembered. And when we're faced with challenges to our Western belief system from people of other faiths, et cetera, whatever their motivations, but let's just for the moment accept, as I think it's true of many, accept that their motivations are pure and religious, right, in that sense. If they say they are deeply offended, et cetera, we have to say, well, we have a sort of sacred right here, too, a sacred right to be secular, if you like. But it is a sacred right in the sense that it emerges from religious roots. And that's why I think it's important to start with Luther. I actually start earlier with some of the other quote-unquote heresies, you know, the Cathars and the Bulgars and other people in the Middle Ages who were moved to break away from the church.
So take us through a British history of freedom of expression and also its repression.
Well, it's the same sort of history, really. I mean, we share it until the last couple of hundred years. The kings thought that they would rule by themselves and that they would control all forms of expression. But with the collapse of the authority of the crown in the English Civil War of the 17th century, it became very difficult for the Crown simply to throw its weight around. It needed Parliament. It needed some measure of democracy in order to function as government. And the result was that a number of compromises were made, out of which the parliamentary system of democracy emerges. And as part of that, freedom of expression also emerges. Now, freedom of expression was never an absolute. You can't say what you like. As the famous American legal saying has it, you can't go falsely crying fire in a crowded theater. I won't go into whether that's a good analogy or not. But the bottom line is, being able to shoot your mouth off about anything in all circumstances can be very damaging, right? So we have to constrain freedom of expression. And in Britain, that took the form of a couple of centuries of struggle, which were really characterizable as being constraint being applied minimally. The authorities really wanted to assert control all the time, but the authorities didn't speak with one voice. There were two parties, you know, initially Whigs and Tories, just as there were, you know, Federalists, etc., in America and so on and so forth. There are always two parties. And one party was unwilling to give the other one the right to control everything. So the battle went backwards and forwards, and there are famous cases and famous heroes. John Wilkes, a politician in the 18th century, and articulations of free expression, all of which are echoed totally in the American Revolution. And you know, the whole issue of give me liberty or give me death becomes essential to our sense in the English-speaking world of how societies have to be organized. So there has to be a constraint, but basically there has to be freedom.
Where would Benjamin Franklin have fit in there as far
well,
as advocating?
Absolutely. An arch proponent of all of this, I think. Franklin, the function, it's one of the most interesting things, one of the most interesting differences, I think, between Britain and America is that in America, in the United States, the press inherits a great deal of glory from its role in the revolution. I mean, you know, one of the most widely read texts of the 18th century was Thomas Paine. The importance of Franklin and Paine, however conservative they were in many, well, Paine wasn't, but Franklin was in other matters. The fact of the matter is that people understood that the press was absolutely crucial in the struggle for independence. Common Sense, Paine's pamphlet, was probably read by practically every literate adult in the 13 revolted colonies. People talk about the impact of modern media. It seems to me they forget the impact of old media in such situations. So I think that Franklin and Paine and all those other people are absolutely critical. And, of course, Adams, Sam, that is, when he wasn't brewing beer or whatever, Sam was utterly aware of the usefulness of the press in making the revolutionary claims, the revolutionary case. So in America, it seems to me that the press still has, for all its faults and everything else, it still has that capacity to command loyalty from the population because of its function in those days. It's a bit like the BBC during the Second World War. You know, if you do something right, and the BBC certainly did things right in the Second World War, it takes a hell of a long time for that level of support and loyalty on the part of the public to disperse. And I think in America, despite all the things that have gone on, and despite, you know, if you say to people, do you like the press? They don't necessarily like it very much. But they still feel that the First Amendment to the Constitution, that all speaks to a residual echo of the 18th century struggle.
How about if you could touch on the American red-baiting, congressional inquiries, and blacklisting of the 1950s?
Well, of course, you know, the point is that we're talking about an is and an ought to be. The fact is that, you know, we fall short of what we ought to be doing all the time. I mean, one of the things that struck me always about this history is all these great expressions from Louis Brandeis and from the other judges of the Supreme Court. They very often locked up the people in the cases where they make these wonderful remarks, you know, clear and present danger, etc., etc. They make all these amazing statements in favor of free expression and then decide that that really doesn't apply in the case at hand. So we're always falling short. But the point is exactly that we are falling short. We have an ideal. We don't begin from a position where we say, you shan't open your mouth, you shan't have freedom of conscience, you shan't have freedom of expression unless we concede it to you as the authorities. We start from the position we have those things, and it's up to the authorities to, as it were, shoot themselves in the foot to betray their own inheritance by repressing things. And certainly the whole history of sedition, as one Supreme Court judge once said, is lamentable. You know, the idea of sedition is a lamentable one in American terms. And it's the same here. I mean, we have legislation which allows our government to behave in the most appalling fashion. But what you need is for somebody to stand up, preferably with a newspaper or a radio station or something, and say, hey, you can't do that. That's the point. It's not that bad things will not happen. It's that we have modes of redress.
We're speaking with Professor of Communications at the University of Lincoln in the UK. He's Professor Brian Winston. We're talking about his book, The Right to Offend. Mr. Winston, stay with us. We'll be back after a short break.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. You can also join us online at WLRN.org. Join us on WLRN TV 17 for Dr. Furman's Immunity Solution, the program which shows us how we can become more resistant to colds, flus, and even cancer by supercharging our immune system. That's Dr. Furman's Immunity Solution on Thursday, November 29th at 10 p.m. on WLRN TV Channel 17.
Amazing acrobatics with awe-inspiring tumbles grace the stage of the Miramar Cultural Center when Cirque Chinois is performed by the National Circus of the People's Republic of China. You can witness the award-winning troupe's contortionism and flying acts, which have made theirs one of the most unique circus performances in history. Cirque Chinois, Friday, November 30th at 8 p.m. Tickets at the Miramar Cultural Center at 954-602-4500 or miramarculturalcenter.org. The South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center presents a holiday classic that's fun for the entire family with the performance of The Nutcracker. You can enjoy a little girl's dreamlike journey to the land of the sweets, the Sugar Plum Fairy, dazzling costume characters, and Tchaikovsky's beautiful score. Performed by Miami Youth Ballet, Saturday, December 1st at 8 p.m. Tickets at smdcac.org or 786-573-5300.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We resume our conversation with Brian Winston, Professor of Communications at the University of Lincoln, UK. He's written the book, The Right to Offend. Brian Winston, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I'm so old-fashioned. We're over here in the old country, you know. I think I've got a Wikipedia entry, which nobody...
You do.
I never contributed to, I have to say. I don't know whether that's a form of reticence. It's not that I'm hostile to new technologies. It's just that I'm too busy doing far too many other things. But certainly the book is available. I think it's just been published in New York by Bloomsbury Academic. I'm very pleased about that, me and Harry Potter. I suspect Harry Potter sells rather more copies than I'm likely to, but there you go.
How about an analysis of today's American TV network news today, which is dominated by corporate giants?
Well, that is a really interesting problem. There's a hell of a lot of of stuff, as you must well be aware of whether the 18th century solutions to this, as you know, encapsulated in the First Amendment, have any purpose or pertinence in today's world. I mean, to put this crudely, if I'm standing on a street corner in 18th century Boston shouting the odds against the British Crown, how does that right relate to Rupert Murdoch owning a huge chunk of the communication infrastructure? Isn't it now the case, and some scholars argue this, that the 18th century saw the real problem as being the state, you know, intervening to suppress the citizen's right? But isn't it now the case that we need the state to intervene to suppress the media mogul's right to limit discussion, to try and fix our opinions, etc., etc.? And I think there's a certain amount of that can be said about that. I wouldn't dismiss that out of hand. And certainly, as you probably know, in Britain we're having this uproar. In fact, there's going to be a big report on Thursday, which is likely to reintroduce the principle of state control of the press. And its justification is exactly that the press has abused its power and so on and so forth. My line is, we haven't had state control of the press since we got rid of the last chap to do it in 1679, because we didn't think it was a particularly good idea. And it seems to me there's no reason to go back to that. But even as I say that, I am aware of the fact that there is a problem here. Now, you exercise on behalf of the public the right to broadcast, do you not?
Yes.
And you are licensed by the Federal Communications Commission.
Yes,
right?
Of course.
Now, it seems to me that, you know, the Federal Communications Commission came into being to license the airwaves exactly because everybody was broadcasting on the same frequency, blah, 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 blah. But there's a case to be made for the state actually allocating this precious resource so that the maximum number of people get to speak, so that you don't get these dominant voices. Now, I know from the point of view of our economic system, this would be anathema. This would be really terrible. But I wouldn't mind saying to Mr. Murdoch and others of his ilk, look, if you want to own a newspaper, you can only own one in any market. Or if you want to own the newspaper in that market, you can't also own a television station or a cable channel or whatever. It seems to me that the state has two functions here. One is the possible control of content. Now, for all of us, that is not on. We have the law. You know, if the principle is do not speak and do harm, then the law exists. And I know this is all vexed, you know, what is harm, blah, blah, blah. But basically, the law exists to sort that out. We don't need state regulation. And we have it in Britain, much to my disgust, to come in and say, you shan't do this and you shall do this and all these other things. You should not have that. There should be no allocation of content. Oh, sorry. There should be no control, regulation of content outside of the law by any state agency such as the Federal Communications Commission. On the other hand, I think an agency such as the Federal Communications Commission has every right to intervene in the marketplace of ideas to ensure the maximum amount of opinion is expressed, etc., etc., without ever saying anything about the content of the communications that go on those channels. So, you know, before the 80s, the FCC had a crude but not entirely ineffective method of doing this. They said, you know, eventually got up, didn't it, to 7 FM licenses, 7 AM licenses, 7 television channels, and you couldn't own a newspaper wherever you held right. those licenses. That seemed to me, you know, that's not going to work in today's communication environment, but that sort of idea strikes me as being a perfectly reasonable one. You know, the state ought to be able to do that. If you get a situation where somebody's taking over all of these things, I mean, I forget, is it Clear Channels now has 2,000 licenses? You know, Murdoch has over 30. I mean, come on, this is not what was intended. People go on about how, you know, the 18th century doesn't apply. Well, that's not what That's not the alternative to allow for this dominance. So I'm all for the state intervening to allocate and to say, look, the right to speak and the right to speak to a mass, the right to own a channel of mass communications is absolutely crucial right, and we can't let you abuse it. That seems to me to be perfectly reasonable. And if you're saying, you know, back will come the reply, well, we need economies of scale, blah, 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 I don't know that that's proven at all. I don't know that that's the case at all. It seems to me you can have perfectly good communication systems at a very small scale. I remember when I was in America, which I was for years, I was always very impressed by a chap called Lauren Giglione, who I think ran the Stourbridge, Massachusetts paper, you know, which was a weekly with a few thousand circulation. He ran it very well. He's extremely distinguished. In fact, one year he was the head of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. I mean, that seems to me ideal. You know, why would you not want to have regulation that actually intervened in the marketplace to protect that tradition, that great tradition? It seems to me that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do.
Brian Winston, the title of your book is The Right to Offend. I would assume that means the right to be uncivil. But what about hate speech?
Well, I mean, America manages to get by with less restriction on speech than almost any other democracy at this point. We've got a lot of regulations about hate speech. I think that speaks to the assumption of the effect of speech. It seems to me that hate speech is to do with all sorts of deep-seated factors in society, one of the most important of which is, you know, defining yourself by saying you're not the other. I mean, you know, somebody, Linda Colley, a great historian, described Britain, you know, which was an invention of the 18th century, of course, cobbled together from England, Ireland, Wales, and Scotland, right? Britain, she said, well, you knew you were British if you weren't French and if you weren't a Catholic, right? I mean, you know, it's always defining yourself as negatives. So, you know, the Jewish people have functioned in that way across Europe. That's what Jews are. They are the other. So are the Romani. So are all sorts of people, right? The other, the other, the other. And if you say, let's not have any speech about that, let's suppress all that speech, you're not going to make that psychological reality go away. I always say, you know, let's think about Luther, another aspect of Luther. You know, are we, you know, Luther wrote a pamphlet in, I think, 1543, in which he argued, called On the Jews and Their Lies, right? And it's virtually a blueprint for the Holocaust. It doesn't recommend killing people, but it recommends putting them in outhouses, you know, making them menial, blah, 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 all of those things. Are we saying that that is responsible for European anti-Semitism? And had Luther stuck to his original document, which was published 20 years earlier, where he says, I think it's called, Jesus Was Born a Jew, yes? And in that he says, you know, the way the church behaves, and he's talking about the Catholic Church, of course, the way the Catholic Church behaves, who would want to join them? It's an outrage. Are we saying that those two documents, if he hadn't written the second one, the history of European anti-Semitism would have been different? Of course I overstate. But, I mean, you know, that's what we're saying. We're making assumptions about effect, which I don't think are warrantized. You can't be sure about that. And therefore, I think the argument... And here, let me, having cast aspersions
I have
on
to,
Wendell...
I have to be going pretty soon, sir.
Okay. Let me just say, having cast aspersions on Wendell Holmes and Brandeis, let me now go the other way and finish on this point. You know, the answer to hate speech, Brandeis said famously, is simply more speech. Thank you for talking to me.
It's been my pleasure, our pleasure. Brian Winston, Professor of Communications at the University of Lincoln, UK. His book is called The Right to Offend. Have a good evening, sir. Thank you.
And you too. Thank you so much for talking to me. Bye.
Ariel Gonzalez, literary contributor, is next.
We'll be back to Topical Currents in just a moment here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. You can also stream us online at WLRN.org. Lynn University invites you to its open house for graduate and evening students on Wednesday, November 28th at 5:30 p.m. on their Boca Raton campus. When you attend an open house at Lynn University, you get the chance to hear all the ways programs at Lynn are designed around you, like flexible scheduling and small class sizes. You can meet with deans and program chairs, receive financial aid counseling, complete your application, and register for classes. Information at 561-237-7900 or at lynn.edu. We're funded by listeners like you and by U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Learn how memory has the power to change the world at a free public event on December 9th in Boca Raton, marking the museum's 20th anniversary. It's also an opportunity to honor local Holocaust survivors and World War II veterans. Details at ushmm.org/neveragain and at 866-99-USHMM.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman returns tomorrow. In his memoir, The End of Your Life Book Club, Will Schwalbe introduces us to his mother, who struggled unsuccessfully with cancer for a year and a half. During that time, she and Schwalbe indulged their love of reading. They discussed dozens of books, fiction and nonfiction, classic and modern, almost all of which, in one way or another, helped them better appreciate life and accept the inevitability of death. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Schwalbe. He began by asking him what his mother meant when she said that reading was the opposite of dying.
What Mom meant is that as long as you're reading, you're alive, that reading is doing something. She was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2007, and that's the most lethal of all cancers, so she knew she was dying. But as long as she was reading, she was alive. She was meeting new worlds and hearing new voices and learning new things. So that's really the definition of life in many ways.
You said that pancreatic cancer is one of the most lethal of cancers. It does have a high mortality rate. Why is it so pernicious?
As I understand it, and I'm by no means an expert on this, but as I've come to understand it, it's very hard to diagnose. So it's very frequently diagnosed after it's already metastasized, after it's already spread to other organs. And once it's spread to other organs, it's almost impossible to treat. And that's why the mortality rate is so incredibly high. Many people don't live more than 3 to 6 months after a diagnosis with this type of pancreatic cancer if it's already spread.
She has stage 4.
Stage 4.
And there is no stage 5.
There is no stage 5.
Right. And this diagnosis took place in 2007, and she died almost 2 years later. While she was being treated, the two of you started your own private book club. Why?
Well, Mom and I had always talked about books. All our lives, we talked books. It was sort of common for us to say, what are you reading? Or what are you reading when we were on the phone or when we met in person? We tended to talk more about books when we were stressed or anxious. So it was quite natural that after she got sick, we would read more and we would talk more about books. And it was actually the first time I went with her to chemo. We were sitting around and we were talking about books as always. And we had this realization that if we read books kind of at the same time and talked about them, it was sort of like a book club. And I said this to Mom, and her reaction was, oh, no, it couldn't be a book club because there isn't any food. And I said, well, it's okay. It'll be a foodless book club. And it was meant really as a lighthearted comment at first. But over the course of the next couple months, as we spent more and more time in chemo, and as we talked more and more about books, it really became this two-person book club, a mother and a son reading together as her life was drawing to a close.
It also gave you a chance to get closer to your mother, to learn more about her. And she was an extraordinary woman. Tell us something about her accomplishments.
She was an educator when I was growing up. She was actually director of admissions at Harvard and Radcliffe. And then she moved from Cambridge with my father. They moved back to New York City. And she was in high school education as a guidance counselor and as a head of a girls' high school after that. But in her 50s, she discovered the cause of refugees. And she wound up becoming founding director of something called the Women's Commission for Women and Children Refugees, which is now known as the Women's Refugee Commission. And that work which really was her life's calling. She absolutely loved it, brought her all over the world. It brought her to Liberia, to Sierra Leone and Darfur, to Bosnia during the war, to East Timor, to Burma, where she met Aung San Suu Kyi, to Pakistan, to Afghanistan. And she just became consumed with the idea of helping refugees, helping get their voices, their concerns, and their needs in front of the world stage.
She went to all the places the State Department warns you not to go to.
Exactly, exactly. Her passport was filled with the kind of stamps they encourage you not to get.
Okay. Well, yes, as you say, she was definitely an activist who championed the cause of women refugees. And even when she was sick, she continued working on these projects. One involved a library.
She wanted to do one last big thing before she died. That was very much in her philosophy of living while dying. And actually, before she'd gotten sick, she had gone on a trip to Pakistan and Afghanistan, one of many she'd gone on. And there she had met, again, with a woman she'd known for years, this extraordinary woman named Nancy Hatch Dupree. And Nancy Hatch Dupree, who was about 80 at the time, had collected with her late husband a collection without parallel of books on Afghan history, 38,000 volumes of all the essential books relating to modern Afghan history. The problem is there was no central library, research center, cultural center in Afghanistan. So it's sort of like, imagine the U.S. without the archives. And how can any country get going if they don't have access to their books, their history, their laws, their literature? So Nancy was determined to build this research center library in Kabul, and my mother was determined to help. And my mother decided that the last big thing she would do was raise enough money so that Nancy could build not only her library, but also build these special little book box libraries to go to remote villages throughout Afghanistan.
And did she succeed?
I'm very happy to say that, and this is actually part of the story in the book, while she was working the phones from her chemo and from her bed at home and from her living room and doing all that, she raised $1 million for the library. And then 2 days after she died, conversations started with the U.S. government that resulted in $3 million from the U.S. government. And the building is finished. There is a National Research Center library in Kabul, on the grounds of Kabul University. They're just putting in the shelving and the wiring, and it will open in December of this year. And it will be the first time since the Soviet invasion that such a thing has existed. And what's more, these book box libraries, there are now more than 200 of them in all 34 provinces of Afghanistan.
Well, we're speaking with Will Schwalbe, author of the memoir, The End of Your Life Book Club. How was your mother treated by the healthcare system?
My mother was treated wonderfully by the healthcare system, but it made her very aware of how terribly unfair it was that so many people who had conducted their lives absolutely the same way she did, who had worked hard all their lives, were not. And in fact, how wonderful her care was made her very angry that that same level of care wasn't available to everybody in America. She was very involved, very obsessed, very upset in her last 2 years about the disparity in healthcare in America.
Well, you and she saw what happened to those who didn't have money, because your parents have some resources, I gather.
Well, it was mostly that my mother had been an educator, so she had TIA CREF, which is wonderful. She was of a certain age, so she was on Medicare. And that horrible donut hole where you run out of the government coverage at one level and it doesn't pick up again until you get to another level, they did have enough resources to cover the donut hole.
And go into the donut hole a little bit more detail, because people may not understand it. It's when the government will pay for your medication up to a certain point, correct?
Up to a certain point. And then they pick up again at another point. But it's almost like, imagine you were eating a donut and you got like mouthful of cake, then donut hole, nothing, and then mouthful of cake, mouthful of cake. So the donut hole is that amount of money you have to spend before the government we'll give you more money for your life-saving medicines, for these medicines that prolong your life and that make life bearable. And they did have enough resources, as many people do, to cover the donut hole, but she was acutely aware of how many people don't.
And she was very generous. She helped someone out, didn't she?
Well, that was very typical of my mother. We were standing waiting for the prescriptions, and she saw a young woman who was crying, clearly crying. And my mother was the kind of person, if someone was crying, she went right up to them and said, "What's wrong?" And I'm funny. I'm a little different. I always say to my mom, "Isn't that intruding?" And she said, "Look, if they don't want your help, they'll tell you. But how can you not walk up to them?" So in that moment, she walked up to this woman. My cell phone rang. I went out in the hallway to take a call. And I knew when I came back what had happened. I said, "Mom, what was that all about?" And it turned out that it was a young woman who was trying to buy her mother's medicine, and her mother was in the donut hole. And I said to Mom, "You paid for that woman's medicine, didn't you?" And she said, "Yeah." And then she said, classically, "Don't tell your father."
Well, there was a poignant moment, it really touched me, when she shows you her wig. Tell us about it.
Well, at one point I was, Mom loved Florida. She loved the warmth. She loved Vero Beach. And so when she was sick, in as much as she could and continuing her chemo, she liked to come down here during the 2 winters when she was sick. And this was on a visit to Vero Beach. And we were sitting around talking, and she said, "Wait, I have a surprise for you." And my mother wasn't big on surprises, so I couldn't imagine what this surprise would be. So I sat, and a little time went by, and I shouted, "Mom, are you all right?" "Yeah." So out she came, and she had a wig. And it looked like some slightly odd hat. It was a Jackie Kennedy-style bouffant. It was a mixture of different grays, and it sat very uneasily on her head. And she said, "What do you think? What do you think of the wig?" And I lied. I said, "It looks great, Mom. You look great." And she said, I think the wig is going to be the difference between my looking sick and not looking sick." Because she'd been undergoing chemo for a long time, and her hair was very thin. So she went back, took the wig off, and we went out about our day. And the thing is, she never wore the wig again. And I think she could tell, no matter how hard I tried to hide it, that she could see in my face and hear in my voice that the wig didn't look right at all.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with author Will Schwalbe. This is Errol Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN.
And this is WLRN 91.3, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. City Year Miami unites a diverse group of 17 to 24-year-olds for a year of service as tutors, mentors, and role models who make a difference to students and schools. You can learn more online at cityyear.org. City Year, give a year, change the world. During difficult times when families fall into economic hardship, the Cooperative Feeding Program provides support. They now supply 60 showers a day to individuals and families who've lost their homes. More info at feedingbroward.org. That's a message from the WLRN Community Bulletin Board.
It's the 7th Annual Overtown Holiday Spectacular at the historic St. Agnes Episcopal Church, 1750 Northwest 3rd Avenue in Overtown. The Coral Gables Congregational United Church of Christ Community Arts Program Young Musicians Orchestra's All-Star Jazz Ensemble and special guests brighten the season with a free family concert of spirited classical and jazz music and holiday favorites. 4 p.m. Sunday, December 9th. Info at 305-448-7421 and communityartsprogram.org.
Welcome back. I'm Errol Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. We're speaking with author Will Schwalbe about his memoir, The End of Your Life Book Club, which talks about the many books he and his mother read while she was struggling with cancer. What criteria, if any, did you and your mother use in selecting books for your book club?
Well, it was wonderful, our book club, because we really read the way normal people do. We read books that were on our bookshelf that we always meant to read. We read books that we heard everyone talking about. For example, we read The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo because everybody was talking about it. We read things where we saw wonderful reviews. The Wall Street Journal had a review of Big Machine by Victor Laval, and that was only about 2 months before Mom died, but we had to read that because it was a great review. And to some degree, too, we read some books Mom had read and loved in the past. We read some books that had to do with Mom's faith. Mom was a very devout Christian, a Presbyterian. But we really read whimsically, promiscuously. One book to another, we read P.G. Wodehouse, Russell Banks. We read poetry. We read everything.
How did your taste in reading differ from your mother's?
My mother was drawn to things with a very strong Christian theme, among many other kinds of books. I mean, that was just one type she was drawn to. So, for example, one of her absolute favorite books was Gilead by Marilyn Robinson. Which won the Pulitzer Prize. And this actually was a very apt novel for us to read because in it, a minister who knows he is dying is writing a letter to his son, an account of his life and his faith. And I think Mom chose that to sort of open up a conversation with me about faith. I chose all different kinds of books, but we did have quite similar tastes. It was very rare we disagreed on a book.
Well, in your book you write, some authors fill every inch of the canvas. Everything is described and detailed. Anything not mentioned doesn't exist. Those say everything authors are usually more to my taste. Mom preferred authors who paint with few strokes. What does that mean?
That means I love those old-fashioned, rich tapestry novels, Dickens and Thackeray, or to use a much more current example, something like A Fine Balance by Roehinton Mystery. I want to know at every moment, what were people wearing? What did the room look like? Who else was in the building? Mom was much more drawn to prose than I am. She loved elegant, beautiful, crafted prose and books that had a more meditative quality. Books where you could supply more of what was going on. And that was much more like the Marilyn Robinson type, which I have to say took me 3 or 4 false starts to get into. I was craving adverbs the first time I read it, which I know does not speak well of me, but I just wanted to know adverbs, and I wanted to know what the rooms looked like, and I wanted to know what people were wearing, and Mom didn't need that. She just needed to hear the voices.
We're speaking with Will Schwalbe, author of the memoir The End of Your Life Book Club. You and your mom both liked opening lines. I'm reminded of Kingsley Amis, who, as he got older, would make a joke that he no longer would read a novel unless it opened with the sentence, "A shot rang out." What makes an arresting or gripping opening line in your view?
Well, one of our favorites was actually from a Ken Follett book, Pillars of the Earth. The small boys came early for the hanging. How can you not go on reading if the small boys came early for the hanging? Who's being hanged? What's the situation? Where are we? So we loved opening lines that opened up worlds, that was something hinted at. There was going to be a lot of story to come.
One novel that you read, or you tried to read, was Joseph and His Brothers by Thomas Mann. That's a monster, more than 1,000 pages of convoluted German sentences. What possessed your mother to read it?
I think a friend of hers had told her it was wonderful and it was a book she should read. It definitely had a religious theme, so that was very much in keeping with some of her interests. And actually, it was quite funny because it was just around the time when she was starting to read that, that she was very concerned about a big event coming up to honor the International Rescue Committee, big refugee organization founded at the suggestion of Einstein, and she really wanted to be at that event. So I had asked the doctor if maybe the doctor wouldn't mind giving Mom some Ritalin so she would be up for the event. And actually, Mom wound up using the Ritalin not just for the event, but to read Joseph and His Brothers. And I think on this sort of Ritalin high, she raced through that book. And then she gave it to me to read. And I've never I've never been able to tackle it. And I've come to believe that that book really needs to come with a Ritalin prescription.
Well, you worked in publishing for several years. One book your company published was The Last Lecture, a popular inspirational address by Professor Randy Pausch, I think, a pancreatic cancer victim. I don't know if you've read Christopher Hitchens' book, Mortality, which deals with his final months before succumbing to esophageal cancer. He's pretty hard on The Last Lecture. He wrote that, quote, Pausch used to work for Disney and it shows. He taught at Carnegie Mellon, but it's the Dale Carnegie note that he strikes. Does he have a point? Is The Last Lecture, or books like The Last Lecture, are they too sentimental?
I think everybody finds in books what they need. And just as in, not to make a sort of ham-fisted comparison, but medicine, some people need different books and some people need different medicine. And I think the Randy Pausch book helped a lot of people. There's wonderful advice in it and there's a wonderful life philosophy in it, but it's not for everybody. Just as Christopher Hitchens, as terrific as he is not for everybody. It was interesting. My mother's reaction when she read The Last Lecture was she got the end of it and she said, that's just terribly sad. And I said, well, I challenged her a little bit. I'm like, Mom, you have exactly the same thing as Randy Pausch. And she said, yes, but he'll never get to see his children grow up and he'll never get to meet his grandchildren.
We're speaking with Will Schwalbe, author of The End of Your Life Book Club. Why do you hate book readings?
I hate book readings, and I know I'm a complete hypocrite.
I know, you're here to give a book
here
reading.
Here I'm giving a book reading. Let me put it this way. I hate most book readings. It's because the authors so often do this weird, like, spooky, incantory voice. They read their book like this, and then they read the next line like this, and then they read the next line like this, and they don't know when to stop. So, also, there is something about book readings. If authors only read the books on the page, it's not really a live event because it's all predetermined. So I like book events. I like when authors talk to people and when there's conversations. And there are a couple of readers who are sensational. I mean, I've heard John Irving, I've heard Nikki Giovanni, I've heard Toni Morrison. Those are book readings. But I must say, and I admit in the book, that most book readings I find torture.
Were you an editor or just a publisher?
I was editor-in-chief of Hyperion Books and editor-in-chief of William Morrow before that. I was 21 years in book publishing.
Well, what can you tell us some of the authors you worked with?
Yeah, I had a wonderful range of authors. People like David Halberstam. I worked with him on his last four books. I did a lot of cookbooks. Jamie Oliver, Nigella Lawson, fabulous books. I worked with Mitch Albom. I worked with J.R. Moringer, The Tender Bar, great book. And I also had a special line of Asian fiction in translation that I was very proud of. Works from all over Asia and Southeast Asia appearing in translation for the very first time.
Well, in your memoir, you mention a book by an amazing woman. Who's connected to the Women's Refugee Commission. The book is called The Bite of the Mango. Who wrote it and what is it about?
This is a woman named Mariatu Kamara, and she wrote it with a Canadian journalist named Susan McClellan. And it's the story of how her treatment at the hands of Sierra Leonean boy soldiers, where she grew up, how they chopped off her arms, how she survived, and how she went on to a career helping other people and making a huge difference in Western Africa. And the title is incredibly evocative because after they had chopped off her arms, and this is a young girl, she wandered through the night, snake-infested jungle. She'd had to wrap her own arms in some kind of thing to staunch the bleeding. And she finally comes across a man, and he has a mango. And he wants to feed her the mango like a baby, like so that because she doesn't have arms. And she says no. And she takes the mango in her stumps and she feeds herself. And with the bite of the mango, with her ability to do that for herself, she knew she would be okay. It's an incredibly inspirational book.
Well, I can't complain about anything in my life after hearing that. Another book you and your mother read was Sweet Française. This is an amazing book. It was written by a Holocaust victim and was discovered just 50 years later. Did your mother like it?
Oh, my mother was tremendously moved by Sweet Frances. It's an incredible portrait. It's in two parts. And the first is a portrait of urban refugees, of these people fleeing Paris for the countryside. And the second part is about life under occupation. She loved it as a work of literature, but what it also meant was you couldn't look at refugees the same way. They weren't this mass. It really humanized refugees, which she had spent the last 20 years of her life trying to do.
We've been speaking with Will Schwabe.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. And that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical supervision by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer, also a credit for Michael Stock. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program features regular contributor Dan Ricker, publisher of the Watchdog Report. We'll discuss the latest in South Florida government and politics. Now the calendar. On this day in 1942, 70 years ago, the birth of rock and roll wizard Jimi Hendrix in Seattle. Left-handed, he played a right-handed Stratocaster turned upside down. And on this day in 1953, 59 years ago, the death of dramatist Eugene O'Neill in Boston, age 65. Desire Under the Elms, The Iceman Cometh, and Long Day's Journey Into Night. One more while we ponder the Twinkie defense. On this day in 1978, 34 years ago, San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and City Supervisor Harvey Milk, a gay rights activist, are shot to death by former supervisor Dan White, who upon conviction is given only a little less than 8 years of prison. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And we depart with a thought from Eugene O'Neill. Quote, when you're 50, you start thinking about things you haven't thought about before. I used to think getting old was about vanity, but actually, it's about losing people you love. Getting wrinkles is trivial. This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.